You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great 4th of July weekend, and I've got some great stuff for you to watch this week. First of all, the season premiere of season 23 of Big Brother. My God, I can remember when I watched the first season of Big Brother. House guests this time are in for a high-stakes summer full of big risks and big rewards, where one wrong gamble could cost them everything, because these are people that have given up their jobs and time with their loved ones to live on a sound studio with little fresh oxygen for the summer. They are plucked from obscurity. They are going to leave the house as household names, and they're going to have cameras follow them the entire time, even into the bathroom. This is going to air Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays, again on CBS. It's called Big Brother. Also on CBS is Love Island. This time it takes place in the Hawaiian Islands. It's an all-new cast of islanders looking for love. You can sit on your couch and watch people make terrible decisions based on impulse and the way someone looks in a bikini, and all while you eat pistachios and have a cocktail. Listen, it's like five times a week. It's on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays. It's like a soap opera for a shortened period of time, and everyone's hot. So it's called Love Island. If you are excited about the Olympics, and I have to tell you, I live for the Olympics. I'm the nerd that's on the couch watching. I can still remember when Carrie Strug won the gold medal after the vault, and I was like working at a shift at Pizzeria Uno, and everybody in the bar went nuts. I mean, I live for the Olympics. So I've been watching Golden, the Journey of USA's Elite Gymnasts on Peacock TV. It's a 6-part docuseries chronicling the journey of these 5 elite American gymnasts as they head to the Olympic trials, offering this really rare glimpse of the moments that high-level athletes endure in their personal lives, training, and competitions. And it's really interesting coming off of the scandal of Larry Nassar and the Carollis. So take a look at that. It's called Golden, the Journey of USA's Elite Gymnasts. It's on Peacock TV. And then if you're into the real estate thing, and as I mentioned, I devoured every episode of The Parisian Agency on Netflix about Parisian real estate. This one is called Lux Listing Sydney, and it's on Amazon Prime. 3 of Sydney's elite property agencies go head-to-head for the cameras. Viewers get unprecedented access to the hottest homes and biggest deals in the country. So if you can't get to Sydney, at least you can look at real estate after watching Lux Listing Sydney. My friend Jay just moved there, and I'm dying to get there as well. This week, I also watched the episode of The Shop on HBO Max. No, The Shop, as I've mentioned, is LeBron James and Maverick Carter. They're the executive producers. It's a deconstructed talk show set in a barbershop. And season 1, episode 7, amongst the guests are Tiffany Haddish, Patrick Mahomes from the NFL, Trae Young, basketball player, Steve Stout, a CEO, and Chadwick Boseman, the deceased actor who became a household name after Black Panther. So what's interesting about watching that episode is he's obviously very frail. And as we all know now, he was secretly battling cancer. And he was just sitting there the whole time and listening to each person talk about their own success. He obviously was very humble. And then they get to the topic of Kobe. And everyone's talking about their special moments with Kobe and what they learned from him. And he shares that he had spent 4 different occasions with him. And although they didn't know each other well, they talked about artistry and the potential of doing some sort of project together. And he said that he mentioned to Kobe doing something together, and Kobe looked at him in like a meditative state, and he said, 2 years from now. And Chadwick turned to his fiance and she said, you know, he really is the real deal. And then they died, I think, just a few weeks from each other. So I don't know. I just watched that and it made me so sad thinking about the quiet struggle he had going on. And my friend from college passed away from cancer, and she didn't share with any of us that she was sick. And I think that I'm assuming that if I were ever to be sick, I would want to share it with everybody. And I'm just always interested in how there are those that keep it so private, what struggle that must be to take on that burden. So if you can check out that episode, I just thought that was really interesting. It's season 1, episode 7 of The Shop on HBO Max. Through the last 5 years of making this show, I've met a ton of really interesting people that work in front of the camera, but also behind the camera. And one of those is Brad Holzman. He's Senior Director, Nonfiction and Alternative Program for A&E Networks. He's hysterical. And he's a 4-time Emmy nominee known for developing and producing some of the most groundbreaking and trailblazing shows on that network, including 60 Days In, Intervention, Undercover High, and Duck Dynasty. And I love this interview because he explains what the role of a network executive includes, the kinds of shows that they want to buy, and what makes A&E Network shows stand alone. As I mentioned, he worked on 60 Days In. That follows 7 individuals as they volunteer, if you can believe it, to go undercover spending 60 days as inmates in the Clark County Jail in Indiana. And their goal is to obtain evidence of questionable or illegal activities within the jail that might be missed by the correctional officers and the surveillance systems. And then they also have the show Intervention, which follows 1 or 2 participants who are dependent or addicted to drugs. And they are documented in anticipation of an intervention meeting by family or friends. So during the intervention meetings, loved ones give the addict an ultimatum. They can go to an inpatient drug rehabilitation program immediately or else risk losing contact, income, or other privileges. And it's spellbinding. And then he's also worked with the team behind Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath, which is this unbelievable documentary series that investigates the Church of Scientology through the experiences of American actress Leah Remini and other former members. So she was a follower of Scientology between 1979, when she joined at the age of 9 alongside of her parents, and 2013 when she left under acrimonious circumstances. And then she subsequently became a very outspoken critic of Scientology and published a best-selling memoir called Troublemaker, Surviving Hollywood and Scientology in 2015. And when she won the Emmy for that show, I can't even imagine what happened back at A&E headquarters, because what an undertaking to make this unbelievable show. So Brad, as I mentioned, is so funny. And I just love how excited he gets about Unscripted TV and how eager he was to share how much he loves his job and what it entails. So I just love talking to him. So here we go. Brad Holzman is a 4-time Emmy nominee known for developing and producing some of the most groundbreaking and trailblazing series, Senior Director, Nonfiction and Alternative Program for A&E Networks. Brad is not only a creative dynamo, but absolutely hilarious, and I've had the pleasure of getting to know him. Welcome to the show.
I am so honored and grateful to be here. I am a fan of what you do and how you've talked to many of my friends over the course of years. So I'm so humbled and appreciated being on here. So thank you.
Oh, I'm so excited. Your job is so fantastic. First, I just want you to tell everybody basically the nuts and bolts of what you do every day.
The great thing about my job is every day it is different. But at the end of the day, if I were standing in front of a high school classroom essentially, I find ideas or develop ideas that would be right for A&E. I then talk to a lot of people about those ideas, just purely ideas, and why they would they would make a great show for our network. Hopefully, I will get some money to develop that, and what that means is really figure out what the show is, depending on what it is, and then hopefully that goes to series, and we figure out that, and then I oversee the series. I am involved in all aspects of the series, both externally and internally. So that means I'm basically responsible for everything that gets on air from the outside. And then inside, I help our marketing team. I help our research team. I help the army that it takes to get a show on air. So I like to say that I'm sort of the captain on the ship that have the most unbelievable crew by my side. I definitely don't do everything. In fact, I do very little. The less I do means the better the show is, because everybody else is locked and loaded. So that's in essence what I do.
So if there's a project that, like one television show, could you give a general idea of how many people are a part of that crew?
I mean, every project and every genre is different. So the two examples I will give you that are polar opposites, America's Top Dog, which premieres on June 29th, is a show that myself and a colleague of mine co-developed. It was our idea. And we then gave it to a company to further develop it out. And all said and done in development, 20, maybe 30 people were involved. The show, once it's produced on set, I think 150, 200 people as well. And then there's a whole post team as well. So I'll told maybe 250 people touch that, versus Accused, Guilty, or Innocent is another series I did not develop. I found this film in the UK and we translated that film into an ongoing series. That is a unbelievable father and son team out of UK. They have a very small team in the UK, and for every episode we shoot, they have a small team. So all said and told, maybe 20, 30 people total have been on that show. So it all really depends on the genre and where the production is. So that's really polar ends of the spectrum right there.
So how much of your day is spent watching other unscripted television shows? Are you spending most of it reading? Are you listening to podcasts? Like what are you looking at?
All of the above. I really do think that if you ever stop being a student of this business, then you should leave. I'm always learning. I'm always talking to people. What I hope I do is I consume every episode, every first episode of every series produced. I know my job is to know what's out there and to make a show that's distinct for A&E. And that's what I try to do every day. Also, I'm a fan of our business. I am in unscripted television. I'm not in scripted television. I'm not in film. I'm not in theater. I'm not in publishing. I am in unscripted television. So that's first and foremost my job. So one, if I'm not a fan of it, then I should get out. But two, I put that priority over anything else. So it is exhausting. You know how much television is being produced every day, but I try to watch. But what I really try to do is I try to give kudos and a short email or a text to the people that are producing the best content on television for two reasons. One, I think every great show on television advances our genre further. Mm-hmm. And who knows at one point, am I going to want to be in business with that person? Am I going to want to ask for some favors? Maybe I'll be on the other side of the table and they'll be a buyer. Who knows where anybody will be? It's a very close-knit business that has a lot of people and a lot of reach. But I do want to be in business with the best people on this planet, and I want them to hear it. There's nothing that makes you happier than somebody that does that to me on one of my projects. And one of the best times was I had a producer, 60 Days In is one of the projects that is one of my babies that I've overseen from the beginning. And a producer texted me from a lunch they had in LA overhearing two producers talk about 60 Days In. And that was the greatest feeling. Yeah. That three people not connected to the show at all, mm-hmm, told me about it. And I like to do the same for others as well.
So let's talk about some of the shows. You really are touching some of the greatest. The A&E Network makes some really gritty, fantastic shows. So actually my first question is, What would you say is the archetype of a great A&E show? What makes something an absolute A&E hit?
I think the word distinct gets thrown out a lot in our business, but I do think that every A&E show that's been a hit has been distinct in the marketplace. They may have had a DNA of something. So 60 Days In has a DNA of jail and incarceration, and there's been plenty of shows in that. But what we do is we flip it on its head. And what we say is, if we're 10% different in a genre, we're 100% to the audience. So I think that's what makes it. Also, we lead with shows that people want to watch on any given night. There's an entertainment factor to it, but behind it, that's more important is the purpose to it. So what we don't just do is put on entertainment shows. And I know, Kate, that you love entertainment shows, as do I. I am a Housewives lover. And that's a pure entertainment show. We can't do that. Just A&E can't do pure entertainment. Our audience comes to us for the purpose, but they want to consume kind of the meat of the show first. So on that. And then I think third, it's the innovation or breaking new ground. It is the groundbreaking. It's the trailblazing. We want people to go, how did you do that? How did you figure that out? Why didn't I think of that type show? Because that's what the audience and most of America would think as well. There's so much competition out there that we have to have somebody. The way that a linear network works is what A&E is if we premiere a show at Thursday at 10 o'clock, you kind of have to watch it Thursday at 10 o'clock-ish, that maybe later in the night or within 3 days or so. So what about that show also causes you to stop everything, stop watching news, stop watching sports, stop watching Netflix, stop watching NBC, whatever network you're wanting, and watch an A&E show. So we also have to answer that question of why would you ever want to watch that show on any given night? So it is a bit needle in a haystack, but I think our team led by Elaine Fontaine Bryant, who is an unbelievable creative exec, and everybody above her, we're kind of a really good team that have been really lucky to work with creators and producers that have found those needles in a haystack.
So let's talk about some of the shows. 60 Days In.
Yes.
Where did this concept come from?
So it came from a producer who was having a conversation with a sheriff of a jail who had trouble. They knew that they had just taken over the jail, knew that there was problems within, and wanted a cop or somebody to come in and spend time in a jail. That's a show. That's an idea. We were producing together a show called Behind Bars Rookie Year, which focused on first year corrections officers in prison. And in that experience, I had never both voluntarily or involuntarily been behind bars. And through that show, I did. And when I came home from a set visit, my wife goes, "You're a bit whiter than you were." And I said, for three, four days, I saw some unbelievable things behind jail. And just the notion of a personal experience behind bars, hopefully you would never volunteer to do it. Well, with my producer's idea, and he was thinking about this, that's when we joined forces and we said, well, we can't have one person. We have to have a lot of people. So casting kind of led the way, six or seven, because if we cast it like a reality show, everybody would drop out after a day or two. So you couldn't have people that just wanted to be on television. So we said we had to have people with a purpose. And that's the A&E show, is A&E has to have a purpose behind it. So the jail had a purpose because they wanted the jail to be better. And the individuals going in, they each had their own journeys, which led to some unbelievable television. So it was a combination of that. And frankly, it was a very risky show that our network really appreciates the risk. And without all of our network understanding that, yes, there is a legal and S&P risk to this, but also we can't force anybody to spend time in jail. If they all dropped out after 24 hours, we don't have a show. The show's called 6 Days In. It's not called I Spent a Night in Jail. So we really trusted the process. We had a lot of, and I was there for the first couple of weeks. And when I was there the first week and seeing this play out in person, that's when I'm like, I absolutely knew we had a hit. This was not a hindsight hit. This was a foresight. And our only nervousness was once it got to air, would our audience think it's as big of a hit as we thought? And sure enough, it started off well, and then it just caught fire in the first season. The ideas most of the time start that way, is generally a producer has already thought about something for a while. Generally, that's matched by somebody on my side that's already thinking about it. And it's at a very baby stage. And then we join forces together and develop it for our network and still maintain the integrity of what that producer is thinking. Because at the end of the day, it's 100% of a team. The producer is 95% of that. Yeah. But with the 5%, there wouldn't be the goal and the hit that we've been able to be a part of. And 60 Days In has been above and beyond. It's the best experience. The producers are phenomenal. And the way that our network has supported that show is just been unmatched.
Tell me something that you witnessed that the show was not able to capture, something that you probably talk about at a dinner party. Like, this is something I just couldn't believe.
Yeah. So the good thing about that show is we have fixed cameras, so we do see everything. So there isn't a minute that we haven't seen, but it was, we were ready to produce the show. 2 days before the show started producing in the first season, the sheriff running the jail was in town. We were all kind of getting together for the last few days before we started production. And the sheriff went to me at a dinner 2 days before and said, just an FYI, none of your cast is going to last a week. And if I would have mentioned that to others on my team, it certainly could have caused problems. I kept to withhold that information because I'm thinking, well, he's not a producer. He doesn't understand who he is the one that accepted all the cast. But in the back of my mind, the entire time I'm there is, I hope he's wrong. I hope the one time in his life he's wrong. He knows the jail more than me. And sure enough, we had a person or two drop out that first season. But that is something that one of the reasons I could not sleep that first week was in the back of my mind. The sheriff said, you're not going to have a show. You're just not going to have a cast that lasts more than a week. So, yeah.
Most surprising fan of the show.
There are so many, and I'm being vague because I don't have a specific. The Twitter sphere loves this show, and it's unbelievable. I mean, I have screenshotted so many people's tweets. They are so fantastic and hilarious and funny and how they watch the show. The audience is large. There's secret Facebook pages on it that it's such a bizarre world to be in pop culture. And then, like all, we licensed the show to Netflix in the UK first, and now in the US, that has garnered a whole new audience of a show that premiered years ago. So we just know we have this unbelievable loyal audience, and we listen, by the way, like we hear this, not any one comment changes, but if you have volume on your show, it is something that it's fascinating real-time feedback. Do I change things as a result? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. But it either validates or it says, well, maybe we should think about this. So I love hearing our audience and any form that they speak. And I'm always open to hear how we can be better with these shows, or frankly, what are we not doing right? Or what do you like and what do you want to see more of? So in terms of unexpected fans, good question. I'm sure I can answer that later. If I start Googling, I could probably find that out.
What show do you think causes more agita for the executives at A&E? The filming of 60 Days In or Leah Remini's Scientology show? Because I get stressed watching that show. I can only imagine what it's like for you guys.
I would say pretty equal. Oh, wow. I was involved in the day-to-day of Leah Remini. I had built a relationship with her prior, a very short relationship with her prior to it. Leah Remini is one of the most fascinating individuals on this planet. And she is, because if you had been in a cult for so many years, or a religious organization, as Scientology calls itself, I would not be a normal straight human being. I would probably be much more fascinating than I am now. And with that, causes a lot of control and a lot of trust issues. If for all these years in your life, you didn't trust anything, or what you were told is not true, and you've now realized that, I would put my guard up day in, day out. With 60, it's a very different type of fear. It is a physical threat. You are going into an environment that inherently may have some bad apples in it. And we can only do so much. Once they enter that jail, they are property of that jail. You know, I don't have the power. I'm not producing anything. They are in there as property of the jail. And that is a scary thing. It absolutely is. But I think the way that the show, I think, has won in the last 4 or 5 years is that we're on the side of the inmate, meaning I'm not undercover as a corrections officer. I'm undercover as an inmate, and we're directly with the inmates. And the conversations that our participants have with the inmates are unbelievable. They're intimate. They're incredible. They're conversations that get to the root many times of the problem that we have. And I think, you know, that's the one thing that I've been so proud of that I really didn't know coming in, is that hearing the voice of the voiceless, I believe, has helped make incarceration better and safer and more responsible for those that unfortunately have done something that got them in there, because they should be treated with respect and as human beings. And I think as a result of the program, these sheriffs have turned their jails around if they felt that they needed that help.
And all these shows sort of kind of bleed into one another, and it's really showing a gritty behind the scenes view of a very relatable issue. Like intervention, we all know somebody who's suffering with addiction issues. So how has that experience opened your eyes to addiction?
You know, just to speak to that forefront, I think what A&E does best is takes problems that we all deal with, evergreen problems, and put a light on it and do it in a way where I think have affected millions of people. What we're not doing is preaching to you. We're not saying there's an opioid crisis out there, stop using drugs, because that's not going to happen. You know, that what we can show is the raw and visceral experience of somebody on death's door. And that's what intervention is. And then with the help of that family and friends making the hardest decision of their lives, most of the time, family and friends are enablers. I don't know if I would, but I'm assuming most people would do that because you don't want your loved one to die. Yeah. So what we're doing is enabling, and enabling actually is bad. And what we do in that show, the whole method that we use, is you're cut off, you're done. So the one thing that I think intervention has done, and what I've realized and definitely understand, is most of the time, addiction, I would say 99.99% of the time, addiction is not a choice. It is something that was affected. There was an inciting incident in their past. It was something that if I were in that situation, maybe I would choose something different, but I would understand why they're doing it. So pure empathy for those that are complete addicts and blown addicts. But I also have an understanding of it's okay to say no. It's okay not to give that dollar to that person. It's okay not to put the roof over their head. It seems cruel that a mother can't bring their child in, but sometimes it's the best thing to do. Mm-hmm. So for me, what unfortunately has happened over the last year, and we're seeing it, is that the addiction's only gotten worse because of the pandemic and because of isolation, because you can't turn. So I think the show is more relevant than it's ever have been. We were going on a down turn, but with outside sources, we've unfortunately turned in the wrong way. And I think what the show needs to keep doing needs to shine a light. And in fact, we have something brewing for the next season that unfortunately takes the series to a place where I didn't think we were going to go, but we're only responding to the environment. And I think we had to act. So, it's something that I can't say further, but it's something where the show has always been of the moment. It's been visceral. It happens now. It's cultural conversation. And I think this next season, we're going to mention what we're really in for, because it is the addiction universe right now is not pleasant. It is not. It is killing more people than it's ever have been. And we're going to unfortunately show you the truth of that, and hopefully have you understand, and throughout the series, that you be careful out there and ask for help. And it's okay to ask for help. And it's okay to raise your hand and say, I don't know where to turn, but I need help now.
Do you ever worry that those that are featured, they're already in such a difficult place in their life, that the added cameras rattles them all the more?
There's such a history with the series that happened way before me too. I've been on the show for 9.5 years now. So I've seen a lot. I did not see the beginning, but GRB, the production company behind it, have taken such care of the show that I only imagine that that was part of the worry. But in fact, over time, one, it's never been proven true at all, not even a second. The amount of people that have been saved over the course of years, I think it's 3 to 5% if you voluntarily go to a 90-day program is your sobriety rate. That totally could be wrong, but it's a small percentage. I believe we're at 65 to 70% of those that have gone through intervention are sober today. I mean, it's an unbelievable mass. We are not choosing people because we know that they can get sober. That is not any element. It is, are these people going to die tomorrow? And we have we are going to save them. So they are absolutely on the, you know, so in terms of the cameras, I've always thought that too. I was more worried about after the fact that when they're sober, is it going to be a trigger by seeing them on television? And in fact, it's just the opposite, because the support that an individual gets after an episode has premiered is so unbelievable. It is, I'm so proud of you. I am so excited for you. You made the right decision. You know, it was beautiful. You're helping others. The praise and comfort for others that others have put on those individuals have been so far great, so that they are so proud to say that they're sober because their story has been present and they feel that it's now on them to help others as well. So it's quite the opposite. I that was one of the first questions that I asked is because I was a fan of the show first. My wife and I always watched Intervention together. And even before I started the job, I was handed this franchise and it was with open mouths. I'm like, is this the greatest thing ever that I could be part of a storied franchise? Even before I started work at the network of a show that I'm truly a fan of, and having that first meeting with the team, it was wide-eyed, mouth open, like, just feed me, tell me everything. I want to be your biggest ally. I want to help this series continue on. And sure enough, my entire career at A&E, the show has been on air. And very few shows, I think, in our television universe in Unscripted can have lasted 9.5 years, certainly with all the environment that's going on now. So, but yeah, it has been a show that I've been truly blessed and grateful to work on because it certainly has taught me a lot. And one of these days, my kids will be able to watch it and hopefully be proud of the work I've done. They're 7 to 10. Yeah, they're 7 to 10. So not yet.
Not yet, but they will.
Exactly.
What is the show that you wish you could have brought to A&E?
I would say the show that's on air that we had an opportunity, not the biggest show on the planet, but a show that definitely I respond to both personally and it's still on the air, is The Prophet.
With my friend Marcus. Yes.
Marcus is unbelievable. I have never met Marcus, but I feel like I know him well. The showrunner and one of the creators or the showrunner of the series now, she is Amber Mazzola. I have known for a very long time and I tell her every day, you know, like I wish I could meet him. Why I like the show is at least from a viewer perspective and from what Amber tells me, is 100% authentic. Because I heard the pitch. I knew the pitch. The pitch was, there's this guy, he knows how to make businesses and improve businesses because he has a system. And a system is 3 P's, people, process, and product. I clearly am a fan of the show and of him. And he looks for companies that are missing one of the P's. And he feels that he has the ability to fix that third P, and what that third P leads to is success. And he will put his money on the line. And I think I'm right about this. He guaranteed in the first season, $2 million of his own money that he will be personally staking other businesses. I'm like, what an unbelievable pitch. Clear as day, great personality. He's got the goods behind it. And it's one of those things that, you know, we've all passed on hit shows and we've all greenlit shows that have failed miserably. And one of those, you know, that show, me and a colleague fought and fought and fought for. And at the end of the day, we didn't win that fight. CNBC did. And they're the lucky recipients of that long running series. So I thought that was a perfect show. It's completely authentic. It's aspirational. Our audience wants to be on both sides of the table. They want to be friends with Marcus and have that opportunity. But they also probably have a business that could use Marcus's help. that could bring him to the next level. And I think that's that was a very distinct show in the marketplace in a genre that we know worked. So I've been always jealous of that show.
What are you looking for right now? So you know, you're taking in a prodigious amount of shows and books and podcasts. Like, who are you looking for right now? What's the story you want to tell?
That's a very good question. I love pop culture relevancy. I don't create shows just for it, but I like shows that speak to the time and that create new paths and that are innovative and be on the right side. You know, I think there are shows in the past that have been so just entertainment, pure entertainment, that now you kind of are embarrassed a bit about. But I want to do something that moves the ball forward, that's distinctive. And really, I love the business of entertainment and television. I love franchises. I love hundreds of episodes. I love making producers a lot of money, because my gift as a buyer is that my company has a checkbook that we spend on content, which helps creators create the shows. So I do look for shows that have volume to it. My friend Howard Lee and Matt Sharp, you know, in the 90 Day Fiancé franchise, they have done that franchise right. The audience just says, I want more, I want more, and they give it to them. And that franchise has lent itself to it. So that for me is what I want to create at A&E, is that show that will be a lightning rod that people will talk about, but that also has the ability to just bloom like crazy. It's almost like, I didn't realize it's already June and we have all these weeds that we try to get, we just can't get rid of it. It keeps growing and growing and growing. You know, I think that's what an A&E show does, because at the end of the day, our audiences are very loyal and want to talk and want to consume more. And we don't have that right now. And I think that's what we're looking for is, what is that next big, you can't start with a franchise. You got to start with an idea that can hopefully bloom. But that's where I think, you know, I want volume. I love that opportunity. There's nothing that makes a commissioner happier than be allowed to call up a producer and say, hey, we ordered X amount of episodes. Like, how amazing, like, that is such a gift that we have. By the way, we also have the hard conversations of, remember that show that we both love? It's not moving forward. Those are equally as hard. Well, not equally as hard, but those are conversations that we have to have every day. And know that as a commissioner, those conversations are really, really difficult. Every show, I have the best team in the business, and every person treats every show that we have as our baby. And sometimes they don't blossom, and sometimes they blossom big. But know that we try to treat each of them as our own. And any bad phone call and any good phone call, they're both parts of our job. And hopefully we treat, you know, with respect, and know that the green light phone call can change a life. And we know that the not green light show could also change a life, both obviously in different ways. So it's one of the job, it's one of the perks, but also one of the toughest things that we have to do.
Is it, when I interviewed years ago, I did interview an executive from the Leah Remini show, and they told me that all of the crew had to kind of go off social media and kind of go under the radar just for safety purposes. Do the members of the, executive team members also have to do that? Do network executives have to do that in a show like that?
You know, I don't really post about my shows until they premiere, they get launched. I think all of us in this day and age, where, you know, you can find me and who we are, and it's no secret where we live and work. Maybe where we live it's a secret, but where we work. And I'm also a pretty open person when it comes to my non-professional life, as probably people know.
Yeah.
Whether it be on Instagram or Clubhouse or, you know, I just love having life, like, fun. I love having fun with life. You know, it sucks to not wake up with a smile, you know, so you can choose not to, but I choose hopefully every morning to have a smile. So with this, the whole social media universe, I just don't want to share things that don't need to be shared at that point. I am not in fearful of putting too much out there, because I don't. Nobody's ever said me, you know, it's one of those unwritten rules, you know, that you don't do, but we don't have a strict policy where network execs can't talk. I just don't want to talk about things until they're real. And until they're real is a press release that says the show is going to be on air. And that's when then, you know, again, I've never been told not to. But I think we're also very respectful because at the end of the day, yes, it airs on A&E, but it's somebody else's show as well. A lot of people show. It's 150, 200 people. So I'm not going to be the one person that hurts everybody else's dream. There's nothing more exciting that at the end of the episode and the credits roll by and it's your first credit or your 10th or your 20th. I remember the first day that I got credit on screen, which was Intervention, and I have a picture to show for it. It was the greatest feeling in the world. And I'm at the end of the credits, you know, which is where I deserve to be. I'm not in the front. I'm in the edit. The network execs are in the end of the credits. But there were so many people, I'm sure, on that credit list that was their first credit or a credit that they're really proud of. So I'm not going to do anything to hurt their dreams. So social media is something that I think so many people after the fact that goes, God, why did I post that 20 years ago or 10 years ago or 5 years ago? Just don't post it. You know, just don't say anything. We all have opinions, but yeah, sometimes you just don't need to share.
Speaking of social media, you performed an Evolution of Dance at your wedding. How long did that take you?
Kate, you're bringing up not something that I'm ever ashamed of. I am a former dancer. I grew up dancing. My family grew up dancing. We danced as a family. It was so much fun. It was awesome. Tap dance was my thing. I wanted to do something special for my wife. And somebody, I think the story was my wife said when Evolution of Dance came out, and if you haven't seen Evolution of Dance, Google Evolution of Dance. Hopefully I'm not the first thing that comes up. It was a comedian that did it on a stage. And my wife says, you can do it better. And that was maybe a year or 2 years before our wedding. And it always stuck in my mind. And I'm like, I can't do it better. I love to make people laugh and smile, especially with dance, because I am a good dancer. I'm not a great dancer. I think what makes me better is I just have fun and I'm just a goofball when it comes to that. Evolution of Dance is perfect. So it took me long to put it all together.
Yeah.
But in terms of rehearsal, you know, not that long. It's not as long as you think. I was so nervous. I've never been more nervous for a performance. One, because it was my wife. And two, there was quite a few people at my wedding that knew my background as a dancer, but never saw it in person.
Oh, man. So
I knew I had some unexpected, both colleagues and friends that had not seen me in action. And that has stood at the test of time.
Well, I can't let you go without also acknowledging you're very famous in Peloton circles.
Yes.
I mean, this is a hysterical story too. And this is coming from another Peloton user. Tell everybody how you became an international sensation on Peloton.
So with Peloton, it's almost in the same version of Evolution of Dance. Peloton was something that my wife first introduced to my household. I did not know about Peloton, never stood a spin class. There was one day where I decided, you know what, I'm getting older, I'm turning 40. I need to get fit. I never had a real gym membership, never took care of myself. It was athletic, but I got by. So I hopped on a bike and it was the worst thing in the world. So I got off and my wife said, I guess that's the last time you're going to do that. That's always stuck with me. And that's kind of what continued my Peloton journey. At my office, it's about 15 minutes away from the Peloton studio in New York City. And I found that out and I started going and it was very intimidating because all of a sudden these instructors, this was three years ago, these instructors were kind of, they were on my screen and now they're coming to life in front of me. But my secret is, and I did this at home before I even was in the studio, Evolution of Dance. I love to sing. I love to lip sync. I don't love to sing. I love to lip sync and I love to dance. So the workouts were so hard that my distraction was lip syncing and dancing. And then the instructors would see me. And eventually it was Jess King and Allie Love who brought me to the front. And this was when Peloton wasn't hugely popular. It started to become popular and they would bring me to the front row. And then after months, Jess King said, by the way, you know, you have this following on Facebook and people, DM me like, where's Brad? Where's Brad? No clue. I had no presence on social media besides my friends and family. Had no clue. And it turns out they appreciate it, because if you've ever taken a spin class, the last thing you do is look good or having fun. Yes, you're have fun after the fact, but you're sweating, you look, at the end of the day, it's the greatest feeling. I would do the opposite. So it would be this bike that at home, you could see me. That was the whole thing. At one point, Wall Street Journal reached out to do an article on Peloton. And it turns out that all of these individuals were talking about me as like, I was the face of the Peloton community. Yeah. And the story that was supposed to be about the Peloton community, minutes before it was published online, they told me, by the way, the article is all about you. And I'm like, oh, like, really? Okay. And then the article so quickly found life online that then they called me up. That same writer said, by the way, it's going to be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And it was.
And you had a dart head, didn't you?
Yes. And then I swear to God, I was in a Peloton class with Jess King that started it all. And they were calling my home, not my cell phone, my home. Good Morning America was calling my home. And my wife picked up the phone and they say, hey, we're from Good Morning America. We want to interview Brad. And my wife goes, I don't know where he is. He's at work. Or she walks down to the Peloton. She turns on the live class and she goes, oh my God, he's in Peloton right now on the bike that I'm sure you want to interview him on. And my wife calls and goes, you got to call. And it was the most, I've never been so proud of him, like to be on good, like I'm in behind the camera. I make television shows, and here they're like a dad on a Peloton bike trying to prove his life.
Where can people follow you on Peloton, and where can people follow you on everything else?
My name on Peloton is Brad Needs Abs. That was my excuse, because the abs of Peloton instructors are really amazing. And I've always secretly wanted to have abs, but I've never worked for them. So that's my ongoing journey. So that was my Peloton feed, is Peloton or Brad Needs Abs. And then I created the Instagram feed, so my friends and family wouldn't be so annoyed about my fitness journey. So it's Brad Needs Abs on Instagram. That's my primary social. And then I do some other things on Brad Needs Abs as well. I love life outside of, I love life inside my job, but I also love life outside of the job. And certainly the fitness journey is a big part of that.
And you're also trying to become a volunteer fireman?
Voluntary
paramedic?
Yeah, so I am a firefighter. I am a member and a proud member of the Gatona Fire Department. It is a world that surprises me every day. If you don't know, 70% of the firefighters in the United States are volunteer.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I had no clue before I joined. Most towns in America, 100% volunteer, meaning there is not a single person in your district, in your community that is paid. In Katona, it's an hour north of New York City, 100% of the firefighters are all volunteer. So it's a parole officer, it's a cop, it's an accountant, CPA, television executive. Like, we all are very different, and we all have this desire to serve and support the community. And being a firefighter is one of the coolest things in the world. So when I sort of learned that I could volunteer to be somebody who gets to go in a fire truck and have a hose line and help support and protect our town, how cool is that? It is hard. You know, it is the hardest thing I've ever done. It was like, it was a 5-month class that was exhausting, and every day doing something. I don't have a life in the fire service. I don't know anybody in this. I've been so in awe of the volunteer first responder community that we also have a volunteer ambulance corps. And they are EMTs. They are 100% volunteer, just like I said. And now I'm learning to do that as well. And to be in the back of an ambulance, helping support and save a life on somebody's worst day. I don't think there's something, anything more honorable. And it's something that over the pandemic, those are some of the true heroes. Actually, they are heroes, not true. They are heroes. And they have supported our community. And for me to learn what they do, I think is going to be a journey. I officially really start the classwork in September, but now I'm just supporting the ambulance corps. I go on runs, I'm in the bus, and I support our incredible drivers and EMTs. But two things, never in a million years I would have ever done, only because of the pandemic, and really understanding what's important in my life. And I love work, I love my family, but now being part of this community has made both of those even better. So yeah, that's another thing.
I'm so grateful for your time.
Oh my God, my pleasure.
I can't wait to see what you come up with next.
Thank you, Kate.
I want to thank my great guest, Brad Holzman, and remind you guys to click subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Also, join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey. You can meet other awesome people who love unscripted TV just as much as you do. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. I'm on Instagram at Kate Casey CA. You can see what I'm watching throughout the week. And I do put out a list of what to watch this week, which you can find on my socials, but also at katecasey.substack.com. And you will get that in your mailbox every Monday. You can find me on Clubhouse at Kate Casey. You can find me on Green Room on Spotify at Kate Casey. And I'm on TikTok at It's Kate Casey. And finally, Patreon at Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey. And those are bonus episodes that go beyond unscripted television. I'm hoping that you have a great week. I can't even tell you how excited I am this week to talk to the team behind World of Wonder, which produces RuPaul's Drag Race. And they are involved in the HBO docuseries called The Podcast Tapes about Ronan Farrow's investigations. So please check that out as well. I've got so many great guests upcoming, and I'm just so grateful for you taking the time to listen to this episode, and hope that you stick around to listen to some more.
Listen to the 48 Hours podcast for shocking murder cases and compelling real-life dramas from one of television's most watched true crime shows. Go behind the scenes of each episode with award-winning CBS News correspondents and producers in Postmortem, a weekly deep dive. Listen to 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.